penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope you're all having a good summer. It's finally upon us. I overdid myself yesterday in the garden. Let's see. There's some flyers on the back table. I'm going to be doing that workshop with Chris on relationship as a spiritual practice at Tassajara. If you're interested in going down, some of you are going to go down to Tassajara this summer. It's a great place. You should go down. You don't have to go down for the workshop. Just go down as a guest or go down as a work guest. But there's some flyers out there. It'll be in July. I'm not sure exactly when. And also, my sister is having a hard time. She's going through chemo, so I'm going to be needing to go up to Tahoe and spend a little time with her more frequently than normal, just to let you know that's happening. So I wanted to just talk a little bit today about just some random thoughts I had about practice. You know, why we come? Why do we sit? You know, we don't want to think about that too much. We just do it. Trust our deeper impulse. Come. But I had some reflective thoughts, so I thought I'd share. So maybe a quote from the Dhammapada, which is, if you don't have a copy of the Dhammapada, it's a good, if you're starting a small little library of Buddhist works, that's a good one to have in your library. It's one of the first collections from the Pali Canon, going back probably to his original teachings, and very short, succinct, kind of like poetry. It's a good, really a good first, I think a really first good book to get, very small, thin volume. The seeker who sets out upon the way shines bright over the world, day and night. The man who is awake shines in the radiance of the Spirit. Meditate, live purely, be quiet. Do your work with mastery. Like the moon, come out behind the clouds. Shine. So, it's nice. Okay, some encouragement there, huh? Some encouragement. So, why do we come to practice? You know, we come for lots of different reasons. We come for a sense of gratitude. We come, to take care of our anxiety, our fear. You know, when Buddha went out, he had a pretty sheltered life. You know, the story is that he got in his chariot, then he went out in the world beyond the safe confines of the castle. Or, you know, a metaphor for ourselves. We go out beyond the safe confines of the world we created for ourselves. And it's fearful out there, meeting new people and new situations. The vicissitudes of life. And he saw old age, sickness, and death. It's pretty scary. And it shocked him. You know, again, I keep reflecting back that he lost his mother, you know, when he was a couple weeks old. Pretty profound shock to the nervous system. And he started practicing, trying to figure this out. So, maybe the Old Testament or, you know, origins of religion stressed more the fear part life is pretty uncertain, impermanence. And how do we manage that anxiety? Well, maybe we can placate the forces. But then as spiritual impulse develops in ourself or in the history of religion, it begins to move, you know, beyond that to a sense of kind of gratitude and mystery, awe. And our own trajectory, I think we can find that. And it's not a linear path. It's sometimes we abide more in fear and anxiety, just trying to hang on. A life raft, please. And sometimes we're really more in a sense of awe and mystery and wonder and just gratitude. I was reading the other day, there was an article on, they discovered a site in southern Turkey, just right up in the kind of northern part of the Fertile Crescent, called Göbekli Tepe. Tetri, Göbekli Tepe. And what they think the site, just recently, recently, meaning about 20 years ago, discovered it. They think it's maybe the first kind of ceremonial religious site, about 9600 before the Common Era. And the history, the theory up until that time was that, modern man sort of came into somewhat of the form, recognizable form like us, maybe 200,000 years ago, developed fire and tools and hung out with each other and tried to find a compatible way to live. But at some point, it became more sophisticated, right around the Neolithic times. And they think the theory was is that they finally figured out a way to cultivate grain. And it turns out, actually, in this site, about 60 miles away, they could still find the ancestors of the wild ancestors of wheat that they think were cultivated. Wheat was... The problem with wheat was they could gather it, but the grains were pretty small and they would shatter when they were ripe. And through husbandry, they were able to develop grain that were plumper, more nutritious, and would stay on their kernels so you could harvest it and store it more easily. And the theory was that, people came together for agriculture, gave up hunting and gathering, came together in agriculture, and it's in agriculture that in fact, in that kind of more stable community, that the impetus for religion started to become more sophisticated. And it was only after agriculture and community that religious sites and religious practices were really developed. But this particular site they discovered really kind of flies in the face of that, because they can't find any evidence of any kind of permanent community around it. So the theory is now that actually maybe religion gave rise to agriculture. The idea is that these sites were developed. And in a need to support this need for spiritual expression, agriculture developed out of that. Kind of interesting theory. But as I was reading it, it's really beautiful, these sites. I've made it a point to kind of visit Alaska and places like that in France, these places where spiritual expression in terms of art. They think actually there's another theory. They think that maybe these cave paintings were maybe even pre-verbal, that it was a way that they expressed themselves, this impulse, this religious impulse, way down in these caves, before they could even really communicate verbally. But they're beautiful, the carvings are beautiful. Really a tremendous expression. I'm very moved by this, by prehistoric art. Really, it touches me very deeply. So some sense of, I think, yes, trying to placate the spirits, trying to, but very much in tune with the sense that there is a relationship of gratitude, sense of gratitude, and how the universe related back to you. You know, because they were so much more in tune with how their food source, how animals came to them, how they found animals, how crops grew. A sense of that inner connection, which we've lost a lot. We just go to the store, we buy things that are wrapped up, and we don't see it so much, that connection. We can distance ourselves into our own sense of self-importance. But back then it was very much a sense of that we needed to give something back, a sense of appreciation, of gratitude. And, you know, so that's one reason we celebrate things like Thanksgiving and Buddha's birthday. A sense of appreciation, a sense of connection. And our religious expression gives us an opportunity to do that. So, you know, we bow. We have a sense within us that we want to bow, you know, to the altar, but to trees and rocks, to children. That's the spirit, that sense of gratitude. And I think that, you know, meditation, earlier forms of meditation really emphasize more working with our own personal limitations. We watched our state of mind. We saw those kinds of states of mind that tended to cut us off from being able to reach out and be receptive in a way of cultivating a sense of gratitude within ourselves. But I think as meditation developed, you know, in the Mahayana, it went beyond just seeing it as a way to manage our states of mind. It went into really as an expression of a spiritual expression of wonder, of just being present. Now, I was reflecting on that, you know, when we really appreciate something, when we appreciate a flower or a person, what do we do with it? We just are present with them, right? We, our small self tends to recede a little bit. You know, it isn't about going and using something. It's about just being present. And really, when we sit, I think our tradition is more that sense of just trying to quiet ourselves down enough so we can be open and receptive. It's an expression of gratitude. Now, I know it doesn't feel that way a lot of the times. You know, it's like you kind of struggle and you're restless and the mind is active and you're kind of managing yourself on your cushion. But really, when you're able to touch it, that open, spacious place, it's really a deep expression of gratitude and just being present. Just like offering yourself as a receptive vessel. And I've quoted to you many times that quote by Mother Teresa when they asked her, how do you pray? It wasn't like trying to manage God or having God, you know, it wasn't like, what can you get? How can I improve myself? Her answer was, I just listen. And what does God do? The interviewer said, well, he just listens to. And I think that's a beautiful statement of what I think kind of more our meditation practice is. If we can still ourselves, like Dogen, you know, my famous quote is, we study ourselves, you know, we forget ourselves, we quiet ourselves, and then all things advance forward in our likeness. That's the spirit, that's our calling in our practice. But we also use our meditation, you know, to manage our anxiety, and sometimes that's where we come from. We're trying to understand suffering, the impermanence of life. Things are so uncertain. And the way our meditation practice helps us do it is not to understand it so much intellectually, but to put ourselves right in the center of it. We actually train ourselves to put ourselves right in the center of our anxiety, right in the center of impermanence, of our mind and our body, just presenting a constant flow of change. And we learn to really tolerate that and be with it and not flinch from it. We sit down right in the middle. The other quality about, I think, spiritual, coming into our spiritual presence, has a lot to do with being able to take a risk. Being able to say, this, the container we've created for ourselves, we're willing to move beyond it. We're willing to take a journey. And there are a lot of really great Zen koans that kind of that address this point. One, I don't think I remember the koan, Case 46 in the Mumon Khan. And there's three, four major books on Zen koans. Mumon Khan is one of them. 46. Case 46. Proceed from the top of the pole. So I'm going to read this to you and just see what comes up for you. There's kind of two ways to look at this. I'm going to actually emphasize more the part that isn't emphasized so much. So, Sikiso asks, how will you proceed from the top of a 100-foot pole? Another Zen teacher said, one who sits on top of a 100-foot pole has attained something, but is still not handling Zen freely. One should proceed on from there and manifest one's whole body throughout the 10 directions. Another teacher's commentary on that. One who sits on top of a 100-foot pole has attained Zen partially, not in whole. One should proceed on from there, for the universe is one's own real body. And Mumon, who collected these koans, says, if you step forth and turn your body freely about, you will be worthy of respect. I want to ask you, monks, however, how will you proceed on from the top of that pole? His verse, one who lacks the third eye of insight will cling to the measure of 100 feet. Such a one will jump from there and be killed, a blind person leading the blind. So you get a sense, right, in our lives, we're always achieving and climbing and kind of striving. And, you know, and religious practice really lends itself to that. You know, if we can just sit still on our cushion, we not move, quiet the mind, you know, purify ourselves, just like the Dhammapada is encouraging us to do, right? We can begin to have a sense that we get up 20 feet, we get up 40, 60 feet, and we get up. So I think what's really sweet about this group is we're actually not very arrogant. You know, I hang out with old-time practitioners sometimes. I get a little sense of, like, I got it figured out. Well, that's what this koan is about. This koan is about getting up to the 100-foot pole and resting at the top of the pole. Nice view. Don't really need to go from here. And what the koan is saying, you've got to jump off the 100-foot pole. You've got to leap out. You've got to take a risk. You've got to go beyond what you think you know. You reach out and leap into the world. It's very easy, actually, to hide behind meditation practice. I meet many people that come, and they practice very hard. They have, you know, hour a day, they sit, hour a day, by themselves. By themselves, they sit an hour a day. It's too risky to take their practice into an engagement with other people. It's too messy to do that. It's so much purer if you can just sit by yourself. You got to leap off the 100-foot pole. You got to take a risk. And it's not easy to take a risk. Sharon Salzberg said when she first started practicing 30 years ago, she was a young woman, maybe in her early 20s. She's in India. She's studying with a Burmese teacher. And then she goes across India and she starts studying with a Tibetan teacher. And they both have really different ways to study Buddhism. They call it Buddhism, but it looks pretty different. One's really devotional, one's very, very mental. and she can't figure it out. She goes and talks to one and asks them about the other. She goes to the other and asks them, and they don't know. You know, the Burmese hasn't studied the Tibetan hasn't studied the Burmese. What do you do? And at some point, she realized she just had to take a risk. She had to get beyond the kind of analytical trying to figure it all out and just jump in and just do a practice. Take a risk. There's another koan I like a lot. This one I have shared with you. This is in the Book of Equanimity. So, attention. Master Jizo asked Hongjin, "Where have you come from? I pilgrimage aimlessly," replies Hongjin. In other words, I'm wandering. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just wandering around. I seem to be aimless, no direction, right? I'm actually why I'm here. I'm seeking some direction. "What is the matter of your pilgrimage again?" asks Jizo. "I don't know," replies Hongjin. "I don't know. I really don't know where I'm at. I don't know where I'm going." Jizo replies, remember his answer? "Not knowing is most intimate," replies Jizo. At that time, Hongjin experienced great enlightenment. So our way is not so much to accumulate knowledge and wisdom and the way of doing it. Our way is to keep our mind open and spacious and questioning, and we wonder. And within that, there's room for us to look at our conditioning and to work with it. Here's a quote from a book that I like a lot, Buddhism Without Beliefs, Stephen Batchelor. Says something about risk. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, it's really about taking a risk. It's about anything you want to lock down behind, any concept you want to lock down behind. See if you can move into the territory of not knowing. Here's what he says. It's a nice definition of emptiness. Things are empty. They are not as opaque and solid as they seem. They are transparent and fluid. They are not as singular and straightforward as they seem. They are complex and ambiguous. They are not only defined by philosophy and religion, they are evoked through the play of illusions, paradoxes, and jokes. That's why koans can be so useful. Illusions, paradoxes, and jokes. They cannot be pinned down with certainty. They trigger perplexity, amazement, and doubt. Not knowing is most intimate. Jump off the 100-foot pole. So, you know, we spend our lives really pretending we're a separate entity, walled up against the world. And to let go of this barrier requires a leap off the 100-foot pole. This last year, we lost three very influential Zen teachers. In the last 12 months, Eiken Roshi, who is actually one of my kind of first inspirational teachers, died. Joko Beck just died about a week ago. She was a concert pianist who, Every Day Zen is a book that many of you have read that I recommend. And Dato Lurie was a very influential teacher. Did a lot of work with prisoners and was a photographer, all three of them. So sometimes people come into this room and they and they see the Buddha statue up here, and then they see his bowing, and it's a little bit strange. And you know, for years I didn't emphasize, I didn't do bowing, because I was afraid that people would get, it would turn people away, and in fact it does. But the advantages of creating a kind of a grateful heart outweigh it, and the advantages of understanding that bowing is an important part of practice. Just mental bowing, a sense of humility and respect towards life. Here's what Robert Aiken says about our relationship with Shakyamuni Buddha, who is our inspiration, right? He says, "We seek for ourselves the experience of Shakyamuni. However, we do not owe fundamental allegiance to him, but to ourselves and to our environment. It would be okay if Shakyamuni never lived. Just the myth of his life would be enough to be our guide. The myth of Buddha is our own myth." So when we bow to Buddha, keep this in mind. Our fundamental allegiance is not to him, not to something outside ourselves, right? But to ourselves and to our environment. So acknowledge that the path is personal and intimate. You cannot examine it from a distance. You must walk the path yourself. Do as Buddha did. Discover for yourself. You need to invest yourself in your practice. This requires real engagement with your brothers and sisters, not alone on the cushion. You need to have a strong desire to change your life by adopting new habits and learning to see the world anew. Meditation and mindfulness is the way that we train ourselves. And we can learn a happiness that is not dependent on conditions. The ordinary person's attention strays according to the movement of the mind, lost in subject and object. Eiken Roshi says, "Buddhas and bodhisattvas have been successful in getting to the dry land of enlightenment, and you have access to it immediately. Buddhas and bodhisattvas have cut the movement of the dualistic mind, us and them, and the experience that the mind takes the form of compassionate activity. Sentient beings fall under the power of dualistic thinking." Let me read that again. "Buddhas and bodhisattvas have cut the movement of the dualistic mind, us and them, and the expression that the mind takes the form of compassionate activity." And then, once dualism is cut, the mind takes the form of compassionate activity. So, I thought maybe we've got a few minutes left. I thought maybe we could just break into groups for a few minutes and just reflect on some of the things I've said. And say a little bit, each of you take a turn, maybe 3 minutes each, and say what comes to you about your spiritual impetus, about what brings you to practice. Okay? Just see what comes up. If nothing comes up, just sit there for a few minutes and I'll ring a bell. We'll go on to the next person. Okay? So why don't you grab a couple other people and let's do this for a few minutes. What brings you to spiritual practice?